You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 235 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you as usual in different locations. I'm in I screwed it up.
You want to start that over? Are we starting for the top or just right there?
Just right there. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Well, it has been a week. How'd you enjoy that Husky game last Saturday?
Oh, man. You know, got to bed early. That was really nice.
Oh, you didn't stay up for the Cougs?
I fell asleep during the Cougs. There was a Tristan involved, so I had to check it out for a while.
We're going to talk more about that later. But for now, we should get to our toasts and start with this beer, which is from our friends at Rubens Brews, their seasonal Moorish IPA, which is defined, this appears to be a dictionary definition, of drink having a very pleasant taste and making you want more, is in these Rubens Brews IPAs are very Moorish, aren't they? This modern IPA is the perfect balance of tropical hops and crisp, beady malts. Bready malts.
Beady malts. That makes more sense. With your beady eyes. That's a tribute to multiple people now, by the way. Sean Connery on Celebrity Jeopardy, RIP.
Wow. Yeah, that really is.
We pour one out.
Oh, man. That was Trebek. Such a loss. A truly sad day. We're pouring one out. A toast to President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris.
There we go. It's not quite a congratulations from fellow Republican senators, but you heard it here on the Pelton Cast. Congrats. This is like Erdogan reaching out and congratulating them. What do you think about long-term calling an election on Saturday morning? Kind of a vibe, right?
You want to wait until Saturday for maximum ability to party in the streets?
Uh-huh. Or be sad? I don't know.
Yeah. Be distracted by college football, I guess. Yeah, it kind of worked out.
This particular one, I should say, is a vibe. Because if you have to have a whole weekend to think about it on a devastating loss, that might be worse.
It could go either way for sure.
I mean, it got called at 8:30 Pacific time, right?
All the time ran together. That sounds about right.
8:30 a.m. Pacific time. I had to go to the Lowe's Hardware after that. Shortly thereafter, it was a crisp Saturday morning in Renton, Washington. I immediately got into my car, put on the song FDT. By YG featuring Nipsey Hussle, not the version with Macklemore, which I subsequently listened to. It's the second time through I did the Macklemore and G-Eazy version. Turned it on as loud as my car would play music and rolled down all of my windows and drove over to the famous cousin Katie's house and said, "Katie, I have a gift for you." And then Katie wasn't even there.
It was a real missed opportunity.
All that Katie got was some very confused, pretty bothered neighbors.
Well, she got something all right. She got the RV. You have nothing funny to say about this?
Do I had to, I don't know. What would I have to say about that?
I don't know. I thought
if we could ever tailgate again, this might come in handy. Yes.
Very exciting possibility. Are we continuing with the toast?
Absolutely we are.
In equally important, monumental news to Kyle Lewis, who was unanimously voted AL Rookie of the Year, joining Elvin Davis in 1984, Kazuhiro Sasaki in 2000, and Ichiro is M's Rookie of the Years.
kind of crazy that some of the greatest Mariners in history have not won Rookie of the Year. Like, if you would have asked me, did Alex Rodriguez, I mean, it's probably because he had that sort of abridged rookie season, right?
Technically he passed his rookie season was 95 when he barely played in the major leagues.
Okay, so but then he was a monster in 96, which is really his first complete season.
Correct.
Which, if that would have been his rookie year, would have been one of the best rookie years ever. And then
undoubtedly,
Ken Griffey Jr. How did Ken Griffey Jr. not win Rookie of the Year?
This is an excellent question. Who won Rookie of the Year the year that Ken Griffey was a rookie in 1989? I mean, he was obviously very young, so it's not terribly surprising that he wasn't like a great player as a rookie, but still.
Did he start from day one?
I mean, didn't he homer in, if it wasn't his first game, it was at least his first home game, I'm pretty sure. So,
but I'm saying, was that the beginning of the season, or was it a similar situation to A-Rod where it was a later call-up?
He made the team out of spring training.
Okay. The back-to-back with his dad was pretty early in the season, right?
I'm not actually sure that was his rookie season. It was his first home game on my birthday. I had forgotten.
There we go.
I was not celebrating, was not watching on my 7th birthday, as it turns out. I mean, so as a
have you figured out who won the Rookie of the Year?
Well, no, I was busy looking it up. As a rookie, you get 264, 16 homers, 61 RBIs, 748 ops. So I get a good season, but not, I mean, basically because of the fact that he was so young, not necessarily because of the fact that he was that outstanding from
day one. Unlike, I mean, two of these Mariners Rookie of the Year, like really Kyle Lewis is the second Mariners Rookie of the Year. Like Kazuhiro Sasaki and Ichiro don't really count in that same way. They were both veterans when they won Rookie of the Year. They were both 30 plus.
Okay, the winner was Greg Olson.
Oh, wow. Orioles. And he's still out there catching passes.
With a 1.69 ERA.
Not that Greg Olson. It's that Greg Olson.
In terms of war, it was a three-way tie at the top, is the rounded by baseball reference, between Griffey, Greg Olson, and Tom Flash Gordon, who finished second in the voting.
Wow. All right.
So there you go.
Jim
Abbott and Kevin Brown, 5th and 6th. Pretty good year for rookies, I would say.
And Greg Olson won the Rookie of the Year.
Yep. All right. Our other toast this week to Jordan Kent, who is named the full-time Blazers play-by-play broadcaster.
Seahawks legend, Jordan Kent, to you. Thank you.
Sure is. It sure is. Did a great job in this role, replacing the legend Kevin Calabro during the seeding games in Orlando and the first round of the playoffs for the Blazers. So very excited for him to get this job. And it's an important role because any Blazers game that I am not at in person that I watch on television, I have to watch the Blazers broadcast because they're blacked out local on League Pass. So you need a good Blazers broadcast. We've been very lucky with Kevin Calabro and Lamar Hurd.
This is an important role for you.
I mean, probably for the people of Portland too. Sure, whatever. But that's what I'm concerned about is my viewing experience.
All right. I mean, I'm down for it. Jordan Kent. Sure. Great. Sign me up. It's better than the mics.
Should we get to talking about Seattle food?
I have nothing to add, but absolutely we should.
You don't, because you really missed out here.
So I don't feel like, if we're being honest, I don't feel like I was properly alerted to what was going on.
I'm sorry. I only called you twice.
You did not. And I didn't answer either time.
You did not.
Some of us have jobs, thank you.
It was called you at like 6 p.m.
And I didn't answer then?
Yeah, those were both the times. I mean, they were in fairly quick succession, but
I was actually working at 6 p.m.
Okay.
If you can believe it, some of us work into the wee hours of 6 p.m.
Burning the midnight oil. I messaged the group chat around lunchtime. So what we're talking about, we should introduce here, is Mangosteen Boba Bar in the International District, which is a place that I'd read about over the summer and had been very excited to go. We had talked about going, but I think it
happened. I feel like there was a TikTok about it.
That might have been. The famous cousin Katie might have sent us that TikTok.
She's so youthful.
I think we came across this during the midst of the NBA restart, and I was just too busy to go at that point. And then by the time the playoffs ended, I had forgotten about this place, or even earlier than that, because they did lunch. I could have gone for lunch, but and then I remembered it. I don't remember where I saw it, but I remembered it and was like, I need to go today. And I did, because I was that excited to try. So this is Chef Tai Ha, who had previously operated at festivals and farmers markets for several years without getting on my radar screen. Those obviously tough during a pandemic, the festivals in particular. And the story goes that he was driving by Pho Bak in the International District.
Pho Bak.
And noticed, I was unclear on that one. Should have asked.
Pronounce Pho Bak, okay.
Noticed that the famous Pho Bak boat was boarded up and asked if he could begin operating out of there, and started over the course of the pandemic. The Pho Bak soup shop is still open and apparently very crowded, because the parking lot was completely full when I tried to park to go pick this up the other night, but was able to park a couple blocks away and walk and go get it. And so his specialty at these festivals and markets was, by all accounts, chicken wings, but has expanded the menu a little bit, operating out of this more permanent location. And the chicken sandwich seems to be the star of the show. So that's what I went with here. The famous cousin Katie and her husband Ben split an order of wings to go along with the chicken sandwiches. And they reported back that they liked the wings better, which is pretty notable because the chicken sandwich was outstanding. We've reviewed a lot of chicken sandwiches over the past 5 to 6 months here on the Pelton Cast. And I would say of the ones we have reviewed during that period, this was the best.
God, oh, I hate you.
I called you multiple times again. So even though it's not, a mangosteen is a fruit indigenous to Southeast Asia, a kind of citrusy fruit. The mangosteen sauce involves fish sauce. So that's one of the reasons I was intrigued to try the wings. We talked last week about the demise of Pock Pock and their famous Ike's fish sauce wings that introduced that to me as a concept and something that I really enjoyed. The sandwich also comes with that as a flavor option. And in the sandwich form, it's not an overwhelming taste, and it doesn't really need to be, because the chicken itself is flavorful. The bread, the bun that it's on was outstanding, really soft and delicious. But it was like a nice hint of flavor that became like steadily stronger over time. And by the end, it was like, I can't wait to take the next bite to enjoy this flavor. So you missed out. You're going to have to get out.
And they have brisket also.
They also have brisket. They were out of the brisket sandwich when I ordered. So that I was going to go with the chicken sandwich anyway, but that was not an option at that point.
Did you ask about the brisket, or did you just notice?
Online it said they were out.
Okay. Damn. All right. Well, this is important news. I mean, if you're saying this is the best chicken sandwich that you've had in this time period, we've had a number of chicken sandwiches, right? From some pretty notable places throughout this time period.
I think it's about a half dozen.
And places that have claimed to be the best chicken sandwich in Seattle, or have at least been touted by various publications as the best chicken sandwich in Seattle. And if this one is the winner during this unofficial chicken sandwich search time period that we're having, that is important news.
Yes, definitely a strong recommendation.
Wow. Okay.
So I'll be going back, and we'll make sure that you will get a chance to eat some of this at some point. Maybe a while. Should we turn to sports?
What should we do for Thanksgiving, by the way? I feel like we need, this year of all years, we need a special Thanksgiving episode.
We already got it.
What is it?
The listener, Noah Cohen, asked about our Thanksgiving our Thanksgiving eating strategy.
The plate itself.
There were a series of questions. He said, we've had Thanksgiving food rankings, but how about Thanksgiving strategies? So we're going to come back to that for Thanksgiving.
Okay. 2 weeks. See you right here.
Yeah.
Okay. Special guest.
You want to bring back Nate Duncan? You want to bring in someone else? I don't know.
What about the famous Cousin Katie?
The famous Cousin Katie? She's the guest that we have eaten Thanksgiving with the most times, undoubtedly.
You know what special guest we've eaten Thanksgiving with the most?
Who's that?
Jan.
Oh, I don't know if the people are ready for that.
Jan's Thanksgiving strategies. Be like, you just walk it along, stop at a Popeyes, you get one chicken strip, a single chicken strip. You're going to want to find a buffet.
Well, Thanksgiving buffet does.
You crack your own crab legs and then you give them to the person at the at the omelet bar. They can't stop you.
So yeah, 2 weeks. Look forward to it.
All right. I'm ready for it.
Well, you know what else we're looking forward to? The 2020-21 NBA season, which is now officially on and set for December 22nd. The Players Association agreeing with the league on that. And then this week we got word that they have agreed to an off-season schedule calendar. And it is going to be a lot in a hurry. So we are, as we record this, 8 days away from the draft, which we'll be previewing next week on the pod. This comes as news to you?
It's dizzying how quickly that is coming up.
The expectation is that at some point earlier in the week, the trade moratorium that has been in place for over 9 months since the trade deadline now will be lifted. So probably like Monday.
What have you been doing as a person who makes your profession in trade grades?
Well,
are you desperate to grade things?
just grading the Pelton guess.
Wow. Don't know if you should do that.
A lot of harsh grades there. Sometimes, as I did earlier, I'm writing about trades that haven't happened yet, like Chris Paul potentially going to the Suns.
What is this trade? Do we know the specifics of what is coming back to the Thunder?
Well, it's not a trade that has been consummated, so no. But
do we have speculation?
Are
they going to get like 6 more first round draft picks?
No. That seems very unlikely. But presumably the main return in terms of players would be Ricky Rubio and Kelly Oubre.
I can live with that.
Rubio finally going to OKC after they drafted James Harden instead in 2009. Which is a very long time ago. So probably Monday trade.
So wait, that trade would just be an extension trade. It would be getting off of the contract of Chris Paul.
They'd probably get some first round pick is my guess.
Oh my God.
It'd work out well for the Thunder, all things considered. But
it always seems to, doesn't it?
Well, not in the conference finals. Monday trade moratorium lifted. We're in the first round against Damian Lillard. Wednesday draft. Friday free agency starts.
Wow.
That's all happening in a 1 week span. So it's going to be, I'm going to be very busy.
And this is like right on the heels of Thanksgiving.
What is good that they're starting the free agency so fast after the draft, because it takes it a little bit out of the way of Thanksgiving. I mean, all the big stuff presumably will happen quite quickly, because this is one thing, you know, that people aren't talking about enough. The plan is to open training camps on December 1st, 3 weeks before the start of the regular season on the 22nd. But everyone has to quarantine before that. You can't just like fly somewhere and start practicing during the midst of a pandemic. So basically everyone, you know, if you want to be ready to practice on the first day, you have to be signed by November 24th, 2 days before Thanksgiving. So I'm sure there will be some stuff that drags out longer than that, but pretty much all of free agency is going to happen between Friday the 20th and Tuesday the 24th.
Wow. You are going to just lose your mind.
I mean, I look back on the lockout after the lockout was resolved in 11. I had to like completely update an entire book that we were doing previewing the season. while continuing to work a part-time day job with the Storm, consulting with the Pacers, and also throwing a Christmas party during the midst of this, and going to the Watch the Throne tour.
Oh, man.
As well as the battle in Seattle.
Remember going to see live music?
I do.
We were throwing a party with individuals?
Yes. None of them quarantined for 2 weeks beforehand. Those were the days. And also seeing Nate Walters beat UW that weekend. Good times.
So you're saying all that you have, man, that feels like it was yesterday. All you have to do now is just go to Mangosteen or whatever. You've got nothing else going on.
I'm not going to Mangosteen either. I'm just grading trades. That's it. In free agent signings.
So who are the biggest names this offseason that are coming up?
In terms of free agency?
Yeah.
Well, Anthony Davis is a free agent. He's probably going to re-sign with the Lakers, it seems. Mm-hmm. Brandon Ingram will surely re-sign with the Pelicans.
It's a restricted free agent, right? Yeah, okay.
So the most exciting player who's like really potentially available is Fred VanVleet.
The NBA kind of lucked into this.
Where it happened in a year where there wasn't going to be that much free agency.
Yeah, this isn't the Giannis free agency. This isn't the freaking
Giannis, Kawhi, PG free agency.
Yeah, I mean, last year's free agency happening in 4 days would have been fine, but like the amount of attention that the NBA gets on July 1st is all of it, right? Like there's really no competition sports wise. You know, there's baseball games leading into the All-Star game, but like it's everything sports wise. Then right now there's quite a bit going on in the sports world, and you sort of just have your routine of like, it's the fall. I'm thinking about, you know, I assume this draft is probably going to be maybe not great rated, you know, just because it feels like.
Yeah, it'll be a weird time. There's not a lot else on TV on a Wednesday night.
At least they're not competing with an NFL game or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, they moved it. Traditionally, the draft is Thursday. They moved it to Wednesday. So they will not be competing, thankfully, with the Seahawks and the Cardinals.
Oh, my God. Wow. And it's that game, too.
Yeah.
Wow. So for your life, you're going to have Wednesday night as the draft, Thursday night as Seahawks Cardinals, and then free agency starting basically immediately after that.
Yep.
I guess kind of nice to have a Seahawks break at 10 days off after that.
It does work out from that standpoint.
Man. All right. Well, Fred VanVleet is on the market.
Christian Wood. Very excited to see where Christian Wood, whether he stays in Detroit or goes somewhere. I mean, Gallo is also a fairly big name. Goran Dragic. But yeah, no Giannis, that's for sure.
Okay.
Should we talk about the Sounders?
Absolutely.
On decision day, they got a 4-1 win over the San Jose Earthquakes to finish second in the Western Conference. It was a scoreless game at halftime. As I tweeted, I went to go pick up dinner not far from here. Missed the first 13 minutes of the second half and missed three goals. The Sounders scoring twice, followed by San Jose getting their only goal of the match. It was 2-1. Sounders added a couple of insurance goals to finish up that blowout win. Now, with Sporting Kansas City also winning, the Sounders were stuck in second. They did move ahead of Portland, and it looked like they were in a pretty good spot for 89 minutes on Sunday as all of the Western Conference games were played simultaneously. Because LAFC was beating Portland 1-0 at home to move up to fifth, which would have put them on the other side of the bracket from the Sounders. But then Timbers defender Jorge Villafania scored in the 90th minute to equalize the match, which left Portland still behind the Sounders with that draw, but dropped LAFC to seventh for a rematch of last year's Western Conference final in the first round of this year's playoffs, as well as a rematch of the Sounders' loss in the knockout stages of this year's MLS is Back tournament.
Wow. All right. A couple of heavyweights in MLS playing each other in the Western Conference in the first round, but this isn't the same LAFC team that we've seen before. I mean, that team that won the Supporters Shield last year and really dominated MLS last season.
Oh, yeah.
Looks very different now, you know, finishing in seventh place.
They had probably the most dominant season in MLS history in 2019 in terms of a regular season. So Very different now. They had an injury to Carlos Vela, whom it's missed most of the regular season, but haven't really taken off since he came back. I mean, we'll do a full preview. We've got some time on this one because MLS is taking this weekend off for the FIFA international break. This match won't be played until 2 weeks from tonight as we record this, the last of the 8 quarterfinals on Tuesday, November 24th at 7:30 p.m. Because of the post-return quarantines, both teams are expected to be without international call-ups for this match. For the Sounders, that means Javier Arriaga, who was a key part of last year's win at LAFC, and Gustav Svensson. They also had Raul Ruiz Diaz called up again to the Peru national team, but the expectation is he won't have to quarantine as a, quote, recovered person after previously contracting.
This is what the Clay Travis types were tweeting about back in, like, August. It was like, is nobody going to point out that NFL teams who have already had their quarterback get COVID are going to be great come November? Right? This is it. This is the Sounders taking advantage of it.
It is. LAFC could be hit harder by the international break, including they will be expected to be without Golden Boot winner Diego Rossi.
I think this is an important time. I think this is the time we talk about an important issue.
Is that the length of the MLS regular season?
Absolutely. You know, we've almost not mentioned it because it's long, but it didn't feel that long.
I mean, it lasted over 8 months. This regular season began prior to the pandemic, or at least I guess not prior to, because the Sounders played on Sunday, the day after we learned about the Life Care Center situation, 2 days after we had the first confirmed positive test and like community spread in Seattle. But anyways, it's been a very long season.
That's not what we're talking about, though. We're not talking about the season is long. That's not what I want to talk about.
Oh.
And that is the show Ted Lasso on Apple TV.
There it is.
How is the show so good?
It has no business being this good. It's a television show developed, not even like off a recurring SNL sketch, but off of two combined 16-minute videos for NBC Sports promo in the Premier League.
It is wild. And look, I understand a lot of other people have talked about this, but watching the show, I was just like, I need to talk about this show more. I swear to God, this is the best television show I've seen in like 2+ years.
Wow.
I mean, it is like, it's high cinema, right? Like, and it's shocking just how good it is given the genesis of the show. But I feel like they just didn't punt on anything. Every piece they clearly tried extraordinarily hard on. And I think the moment for me where I was like, damn, like Ted Lasso as a character is so developed, and every character is so developed. Like and Bill Lawrence being involved as somebody who's a veteran, you know, sitcom person, has Clone High experience, has worked on Scrubs, is somebody who's like been around. I think Jason Sudeikis is brilliant, also helped develop the show or on the producer level, but like.
And writing it as well.
The fact that this ended up with Apple TV in particular is like, this could have easily been, you know, in anchor HBO TV show, right? Like an anchor HBO comedy. And I wonder if these different platforms passed on it and it ended up being an Apple TV, and they made such a massive mistake. But the moment for me where I was like, okay, this is it, whereas I was listening to the music and I was like, damn, like this sounds familiar, the original music on it. And then I was watching the credits and I was like, oh, music by Marcus Mumford. And it's just like every single point that they hit from sort of the like medium indie pop of like the last 10 years of the music on the show to the soundtrack from Marcus Mumford is perfect. Every single sound that they have. I haven't quite finished the season yet. I've got like 2 more episodes left, but like you did not imagine that the show with the ridiculous character developed for these NBC Sports promos would have so much depth, and that I'm like near tears a couple times through the season.
Yeah, would have so much heart and so much sentimentality about to it. I mean, it's, yeah, I was like completely obsessed with Ted Lasso for a week, which also included me going as Ted Lasso for Halloween.
Did you ever get a photo? You never posted a photo on the internet.
We never got a photo. I never got my AFC Richmond badge either to put over my blue sweater and blue shirt. Ted Lasso's trademark look, shockingly similar to just what I wear around on a regular basis, or at least what I did back when you went out in public.
Here's the problem. You need the mustache. Give up on the full beard. Go. I told you, I've been thinking about just going mustache.
Have you?
I think I grow a better beard than I do a mustache, but I feel like might be time.
Can I tell you my favorite moment in Ted Lasso? Which, by the way,
of course you can.
Somehow I saw Marcus Mumford after every episode. Did not put together until now that it's the lead singer of Mumford and Sons. Like, oh yeah, that obviously
is right now is when you're putting that together.
That's really when I put it together.
Yeah.
There's a scene at the end of one of the episodes where they're sitting outside a bar drinking, and it's a sad occasion. A pub, I should say, not a bar.
Of course.
And they're toasting. And even though they're not at a table because they're outside, they bring their glasses down before, as if they were touching the table before clinking their glasses. And I was like, my God, that level of, to like care about that detail in a joke is so next level.
Coach Beard, who is that dude? So a little bit of synopsis if you haven't watched Ted Lasso, which, by the way, you can do a 7-day free trial of Apple TV. You did this on no Apple products because you don't do Apple products because you're 60, but it was
very difficult to do, as it turns out.
Navigating Apple TV on a non-Apple product is not easy. But
it's not because I'm 60. It is because I'm like there's
55?
There's a nerdy white guy anti-Apple group that we all have Androids and screw up your Apple text messages.
Uh-huh. It says like Kevin Pelton emphasized. Or whatever.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. love that group. So the basic synopsis is, if you haven't watched, okay, you can do a 7-day free trial of Apple TV. If you don't fully commit to Apple TV, I don't blame you.
Also, I highly recommend Boys State documentary on there.
And you should be able to watch the 10 episodes. They're about 35 minutes each. But yes, the synopsis is American basketball coach football. Of the Shockers football. At Wichita State. Football. What?
He's a football coach.
He's a football coach?
Yeah, it's just made up that Wichita State has a football team.
Oh, I thought he was the basketball coach. Okay.
Did you not put together the...
When did they ever talk about that?
I mean, I guess that he's a football coach, but I don't remember his situation. Well, it comes up at the end of the season. You'll see.
Oh, okay. All right. Maybe I haven't seen that part. But okay. So American college coach with the Shockers at Wichita State. And gets randomly hired, a viral moment dancing in the locker room, gets randomly hired to coach the fictional AFC Richmond EPL team. It's almost like a major league type situation and I don't think this is giving too much away, with the owner of the team wanting bad things to happen to them, expecting Ted Lasso to fail. And within the first like 30 minutes of the first episode, he's got a pyramid up on the wall and you're like, we're in for something good here, right? Like, it's a good coaching story and a life story. Like, I have changed the way that I'm interacting in my personal life and in my life based upon the way that Ted Lasso acts. It's one of those things where it's like so inspiring and it's about him. And the other piece is, this could have easily been a fish out of water type story, right? Like fucking American Midwest white guy going
to
Europe.
Which is what commercials were.
And that's not what the show is. Like, there are almost no cheap jokes on the show. And that to me is what is especially incredible, is like nothing about it. It's just the force of personality from this character and the depth of personality from this character, including like a pretty devastating karaoke scene. Like the show, I'm up till like 3 a.m. watching it because I can't stop watching. Freaking Ted Lasso on Apple TV. To me, the one thing that it reminded me of the most from television the last couple of years is his fellow SNL alum, which when we look back on this SNL class is going to look like a pretty incredible class. But the show Barry, where you have this sort of like kind of ridiculous sentiment of hitman wants to become an actor.
Yes.
And you're just like, great, like fill me in on all the rest. But then there's so much depth to all of these different characters that are involved. And you're like, damn, like Barry, there's nothing surface level on Barry. In the same way that Ted Lasso, you're like, the premise is Midwestern American coach becomes a coach in the Premier League and doesn't know anything about the sport. And really it's about the universality of having a positive attitude and good coaching techniques more than it is about like I said, like a fish out of water type thing. Like that's really what the point is. And it's about individuals coming together and rallying around a cause.
The show it most reminds me of in terms of tone is The Good Place. And it's not obviously as explicitly focused on ethics as The Good Place was, but has that same sort of like you said earlier, it makes you want to be a better person watching Ted Lasso. But I, to me, like obviously we know Jason Sudeikis is great. Brendan Hunt, who plays his longtime assistant coach, Coach Beard.
Okay, that's Brendan Hunt. So good.
So he came up through Second City in Chicago and worked with Sudeikis most notably when they were performing shows with the Second City offshoot in Amsterdam. And he was over there for several years. So he was in the original commercials as his assistant coach, but was definitely not as developed there as he is here. And I would watch a Coach Beard focused series for sure.
And the relationship that they have, like you can feel it, that they know each other.
Yeah, based on the fact surely that the two of them do know each other.
I mean, I didn't know those facts, but I'm like, damn. You know, Ted Lasso. But okay, here's the last thing on Ted Lasso. I freaking believe that every single person is who they are. Even though like I know who Jason Sudeikis is as an actor, I'm not like, this is Jason Sudeikis acting as Ted Lasso. I'm like, that's Ted Lasso, right? And the owner of the team, you're like, she just is this person. You don't question it. You don't doubt it. Like everything is so perfectly acted. And the moment, so that later on in the season, there's a Nigerian player when he was like, here's a photo of the Nigerian soccer team that he's burning. And he's like, I wasn't going to take this photo down until I was on the team, but I will hear it. I'm like, damn. Whew. Like the show was incredible. Again, I just have to talk about this because it has no business being this good of a show.
Yeah, I was just completely obsessed with it for the week I was watching it. Then I think I subsequently passed that obsession on to Cobra Kai, which is what I most recently watched.
Is Cobra Kai as good as Ted Lasso?
It's not as good as Ted Lasso, no.
I gotta say there's some Pete Carroll elements.
Oh, for sure. Without question. I don't think it's like intentionally. I don't think they were Red Wind Forever, but I don't think it's coincidentally either. So.
All right.
So good.
Ted Lasso.
We're ready to Apple TV. We're ready to announce that 5-year extension for Ted Lasso right before the team gives up like 12 goals. Nothing.
We'll get there.
Oh, we sure will. Let's talk briefly about the Reign, who have left Megan Rapinoe unprotected in the expansion draft for Racing Louisville. The teams could protect two allocated USWNT players, and the Reign chose to protect newly acquired Rose Lavelle, who is currently playing in England, and Allie Long. It seems unlikely that Louisville would take Rapinoe, given the possibility she'd prefer to just retire from the NWSL rather than play elsewhere, especially after, with Sue Bird being here.
Definitely like, try it, motherfuckers.
Yeah.
We know you're not going to do this.
Several other veteran USWNT stars are also available in the expansion draft, including Ashlyn Harris, Tobin Heath, Allie Krieger, Carly Lloyd, Kristen Press, and Becky Sauerbrunn. Louisville can choose one allocated player up to two non-allocated players per existing team. That draft will take place Thursday at 4 p.m. Pacific.
I mean, only being able to protect two players is pretty brutal.
No, you can protect more than two. Two of the USWNT players.
Per team.
Yes. So they had to choose two of those three. But then there's additional players that they have protected. We didn't go into the full list.
I mean, there's not that many NWSL players, right? Or teams, right? So you would assume that a lot would have more than two.
Right, and that's why all these other big USMWNT stars are also available, like similar reasons. Like older players who probably aren't going to go play for an expansion team. So we'll see if Louisville calls anyone's bluff on that one. UW men's basketball, KenPom preseason projections are out, and the Huskies rank 75th overall and 9th in the Pac-12. They finished last season ranked 54th in the KenPom ratings. Also about the preseason AP poll, Gonzaga, AP preseason number one.
Are they going to have, there were a few transfers that happened during the pandemic. Are those players going to be able to play and be eligible immediately?
Oh, obviously we haven't heard word on that. Why would you think we would have heard word on that? There's still more than 2 weeks until the season as we record this. So we also don't have a schedule for you to men's basketball yet. Presumably at some point we're going to get that.
Everything that I said for the last 3 months about college football, you can just go ahead and transfer to college basketball right now.
Word is the Huskies will open the season with the non-conference tournament that it's been previously reported they'd host. So, that'll be how they kick it off.
And if they make these players who've transferred to come closer to home during a pandemic sit out for even a period of time, it is, there's no other way to describe it, but cruel on the NCAA's behalf. You know, they just,
I mean, probably clutching, they won't.
Clutching to whatever bits of power that they have, claiming fraud, trying to use the legal system to hold these players down. Will they stop at nothing?
I mean, they just, I don't think that they're actually going to make these players have to sit out a season as transfers. They just don't ever want to announce anything until the very last possible moment. Speaking of things that got announced at the last possible moment.
This UW wasn't football. The last possible moment.
The Arizona-Utah game was called off.
It really let Jimmy Lake off the hook here a little bit, though, because he didn't have to name a starting quarterback.
He may never have to name a starting quarterback at this point. UW football's trip to Cal on Saturday canceled after a positive test among the Cal defensive line group resulted in the entire unit being placed in quarantine due to contact tracing, and therefore... No, they don't have contracts.
Game. Don't worry about it.
Oh, yeah. They definitely don't have.
They've traced the contracts and they found nothing.
So this was a disappointing outcome. There's a lot of people who are upset at the Pac-12 about this and upset at
Berkeley. Are they upset about at the SEC for canceling Alabama LSU? Like, who are these people?
There's a lot of people on Twitter, as it turns out. A lot of people with
they're Russian trolls, all of them. Anytime anybody disagrees with you on Twitter, it's a Russian troll. Boom, done.
I feel like that's kind of the perspective you're complaining about here. There are a lot of people who are happy with the college athletics system and think that players should not get paid and should have to take risks in the midst of a pandemic. For their enjoyment, yeah. So yeah. That's a thing that happens. I mean...
I wasn't happy that this game was canceled. Like, I mean, ideally it would happen. It would be safe for everybody involved. But if it's not going to be, it's a needless risk, you know? Like, there's no reason to play this game in this farce of a season that they're playing if it's going to be dangerous for anybody.
Exactly. So the Huskies will open their season now on Saturday against Oregon State. One thing I wondered about was that there was a competitive disadvantage to playing your first game against a team that has already played. So I looked this up, and teams this season who have played their opening game against an opponent who's already played are 17-8 so far this season, as well as 10-4 at home. So do not seem to be suffering for the not having any game action as yet.
Mm-hmm. Super great exercise in small sample size.
I'm just saying.
It depends on the team. What are you talking about? Like,
I mean, I didn't have the time.
Playing a game doesn't make Oregon State good all of a sudden.
No, but there's no reason to think that, like in other years, maybe there could be differences between those teams. Here, I think it's pretty random. So, all right, let's
talk
about.
I would venture to guess that there's no difference anytime ever.
All right, let's talk about
the quality of the team is more important than whether you played a game or not. All right, let's talk about Oregon State. I know you're fired up to talk about Tristan Gebbia.
Last year's 5-7 record was Oregon State's best since Mike Riley's final year in Corvallis back in 2014. Belying the results from UW's 19-7 win in Corvallis, the Beavers were outstanding in offense, where they ranked 25th in FPI efficiency, with that offense led by Jake Luton, Jacksonville starting quarterback.
Shooting Luton, starter for Jacksonville as a rookie. We said we need to get these rookies starting in year one, and Jake Luton following through on that, having a pretty nice game.
It could have been a lot worse, says the guy who was playing the Texans defense. But the Beavers were dreadful on defense, where they were 93rd in FPI efficiency. As you mentioned, Tristan Gebbia taking over for Luton is the starting quarterback. The Nebraska transfer played in four games behind Luton last season, starting the game formerly known as the Civil War due to injury. His 55 QBR on Saturday was the worst of the eight Pac-12 starting QBs. He completed 71% of his passes, but for just 6.9 yards per attempt, and particularly struggled in the first half when OSU scored just once on a 15-play touchdown drive. The Beavers had 5 3-and-outs in their first 8 possessions before scoring touchdowns on their next 3 drives, before their final drive ended in a field goal attempt on second down, down 10
so
points.
So bad.
I mean, it made sense what Jonathan
no,
Smith
it
was
did
doing.
Not. Nope. Mm-mm.
It's the Madden play. You have to get the field goal at some point, so kick the field goal now so that there's time when, if we recover an onside kick, to go down the field.
When they missed it, it was just like cherry on top to bad coaching.
I don't agree on that one.
Bad coaching, bad process.
No, Stanford, Jet Toner missing his 4th field goal of the game when David Shaw elected to kick a field goal down 28-7 in the 4th quarter. Against Oregon.
Jet Toner. Yeah. First, so many questions. Jet Toner is still at Stanford. Jesus Christ. Yes. Second off, I feel like Jet Toner was constantly hitting field goals against UW.
Jet Toner has historically been a very good kicker. I don't know what happened. There seemed to be an issue with the holder, because at least twice the laces were in.
And oh, no.
As we all know, thanks to Ace Ventura. Type situation. Laces. This is out, Dan.
Do you want to know some quarterbacks who had a worse DR than Jake Luton on Sunday?
Okay.
I'm just going to... A couple of them.
Is Russell Wilson one of them?
He is. Super Bowl winner Nick Foles. MVP Linger, Derek Carr. Phil Rivers. MVP favorite? Russell Wilson.
Not,
six-time
not
Super Bowl champion Tom Brady. All of those worst ER than Jake Luton in his first ever NFL start.
Well, that is definitely true, I guess. I mean, he was 12th in QBR as well. I've assumed that he was getting a lot of credit for the long touchdown pass that he threw early in the game, but I guess it was more than just that. Anyways, we're not here to talk about Jake Luton. In addition to Gebbia, the Beavers will run Jeff Lindquist-esque packages with starting linebacker Jack Coletto, who previously played quarterback, taking over at quarterback and almost exclusively running the ball. So watch out for those.
You're considering those Jeff Lindquist-esque packages?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, if it's someone who actually played quarterback but it got converted, then it's Jeff Lindquist-esque.
Jeff Lindquist ended up being a linebacker?
We ended up being a tight end. Yeah.
I'm not going to allow it, but go on. I'm striking it from the record.
The listener decides. Third-year starting running back Jamar Jefferson got 21 of the 22 carries that went to running backs in that game as he racked up his 11th career 100-yard game. One of those came in 2018 in Seattle, but the Huskies limited him to 39 yards on 9 carries in last year's win at Corvallis. Jefferson also one of 4 Beavs with at least 5 catches for at least 50 yards of balanced receiving attack for Oregon State. There certainly wasn't much indication that Oregon State had improved defensively from last year. They got run all over by the Cougars, who were without their starting running back Max Borgi due to injury. Backup Deion McIntosh had 18 carries for 147 yards and a touchdown, while receiver Travell Harris lined up at running back late in the game and ripped off a 44-yard touchdown to create that two-score deficit that did the Beavers in. Oregon State also had just one sack of WSU true freshman quarterback Jaden Delora, which is surprising given that senior outside linebacker Hamika Rashid Jr. had 14 sacks last year, ranking third nationally.
WSU's quarterback is a true freshman.
Yes, he is.
Man, they looked pretty good.
They did look very good for
kind of scary
true freshman and their backup running back.
I mean, I suppose we'll get a sense fairly shortly. You know, in the season where the Apple Cup's like the third game of whether that is because Oregon State's defense is terrible or if they're actually good. I'm going to go ahead and guess it's the former. You know, this might be Richard Newton season.
It might be a number of running back season.
Yeah, we don't know who. I would still love a situation where Oregon State in a game against UW was running the ball 22 times. I would implore them to do that every time they run, would be happy.
It's 22 that many?
It is that many, yes. If you're Oregon State, it's that many.
And it is relative to the Bills last week.
You know, the Huskies got a bit of a break by not starting out with possibly the best quarterback in the Pac-12. And Chase Garbers and are playing.
We're going that far now?
What?
We're going that far with Chase Garbers now?
You don't think he's possibly one of the best quarterbacks, possibly the best quarterback in the Pac-12?
I mean, I suppose it's possible. Also, I mean, we'll see how long Davis Mills stays in contact tracing.
I'm just saying it's a conversation. But starting off the season with Oregon State, who look like they could be one of the worst teams in the Pac-12. It's a softer landing. You know, this is having Eastern at the beginning of the season, somebody like that. This is non-conference game that they're playing.
I would not go that far.
More so than Cal, at the very least.
I mean, it's the easiest game you're going to play in the Pac-12 North is home versus Oregon State.
Absolutely. And somebody who's been, you know, Cal's been a foil for UW these last couple of years and have been difficult to beat, and to move on to Oregon State to just be able to use the little cloud in Mario 3, skip past that level and go right to Oregon State it's a nice way to start the season and to ease in starting quarterback, whomever they are.
Starting quarterback. I forget what the alphabetical order is here. Kevin Thompson or Jacob Sermon.
Starting quarterback, what's his name?
Ethan Garvers or Dylan Morris.
There you go. You named them all. Did you see the thing that Kevin Thompson was like 6 months younger than Patrick Mahomes?
I sent you the thing that he's 6 months younger than Patrick
Wild.
Mahomes. He still has another year of eligibility left, by the way. I think.
We're like we're nearing borderline Chris Wanky type situations. Brandon Whedon.
He tweeted this is the last ride, I think, last week. So it doesn't sound like he's planning on coming back for that seventh year of eligibility.
This is the last ride. I mean, we still know nothing about this UW team, obviously, because the game was canceled last week. But the one thing that we do know is the amount of talent on this UW team versus Oregon State it's really not close. On both sides of the ball, have to feel pretty confident about this one and their ability to. I imagine it'll probably be a fairly conservative offensive attack. I think they'll run the ball quite a bit. And if the defense can hold up, I think the Huskies can win this game pretty comfortably. I mean, they're going into it as almost two touchdown favorites, and that feels about right.
Chances of victory?
Pretty hard to do week one. Week one in a pandemic where we have no idea what we're talking about, but just kind of seeing Oregon State last week against a Wazoo team playing a true freshman starting quarterback, I feel like they have to be close to 80%.
I was going to say higher than that. I mean, they are 13.5-point favorites. I'd say at least 85%. So
we'll see if the game happens.
That's that too. Each week we're
8 o'clock start time, by the way. Are you kidding me?
Each week we're gonna have to do chances of victory, chances the game actually happens.
Freaking 8 o'clock. It's fucking Pac-12. God, I hate it. Most of the game will be happening on Sunday in the Eastern time zone.
Yep.
This Rainier can that I had in the freezer developed a hole in the bottom of it, and I almost had to shotgun it. Felt like I was maybe tailgating a Husky game there for a second.
Had to shotgun it.
All right, let's wrap it up with the Seahawks coming off a 44-34 loss last Sunday in Buffalo that was maybe not as competitive as the final score indicated. So the defense, it's not good.
That's all your topics?
That's all my topics. We had hoped that the 49ers game was the Seahawks defense turning the page, and then they get Jamal Adams back and Carlos Dunlap, and all of a sudden, here we go. And they got a lot of sacks.
The defense is obviously not good. But can we just fucking stop with the let Russ cook means that the defense is worse type situation? This line of reasoning, it literally is, if we don't test, there won't be cases level argument. It's, we're in 2020 and we know that defense is more than just raw points. Like, if the team was running the ball more and not passing as much, they would give up less points. No fucking shit. But that doesn't matter because it's 2020 and we can judge efficiency stats. We don't need to just look at raw points to judge a defense. And it's not the be all and end all. Like, the defense is bad and they played bad, but it has nothing to do with what the offense is doing.
I mean, I've got some unfortunate news for you, which is that the people who are making this argument are not considering efficiency stats. They cannot and will not. Yeah, it's hard.
They choose not to. They can.
It's hard for me to believe that passing on early downs is responsible for Quentin Dunbar giving like 15 yards of separation on every play because of the fact that he's trying to play through a knee injury.
Do you think that's Quentin Dunbar making that choice, or is that the coaching making that choice? I feel like a player on the field is not like, yeah, I'm going to stand back there. Yeah.
Them having Quentin Dunbar play off that much because of the fact that he's playing through an injury.
I mean, the things that are wrong with the defense are so deep. Like, the whole thing is broken.
Also, the defense was bad last year. They just got some turnovers sometimes.
And look, if they would have gotten some turnovers sometimes in this game, maybe the outcome would be different. Like, it's the Seahawks defense at its core is based off either you have elite level talent or you get fucking lucky, or you rely on things that are not replicable long term. And that is what the base level of this Pete Carroll defense is about. And sometimes you have the best defense in the league because you have all of the best players. But a lot of the times it's not the case. I still think that if there was a team who approached a game the way that the Bills approached this game against the 2013 defense, they would have fucking roasted the Seahawks. Like,
I don't agree with that, because we saw teams try to pass every down once they got down against the Seahawks, and it didn't go great.
That might be the case.
I don't know if you're aware that they played. Are you aware of this? They played one of the highest scoring offenses of all time in the Super Bowl. Do you know how many points that offense scored? That's not an efficiency stat. Their efficiency wasn't great either.
I might be overjudging the Falcons game where they just, but the end of all these games,
but that wasn't the 2013 team that played the Falcons game. That was a team, the Falcon, that happened. And then they went out and signed both Michael Bennett and Cliff Avril. It was a great offseason.
There were times even in 2013 where if a team at the end of the game needed a touchdown, they were scoring a touchdown. And just instantly, this has been a consistent of Pete Carroll defenses forever. If teams want to just pass on this defense, they are able to pass on this defense.
I don't know if you're aware of this. There was a drive where a team needed to score a touchdown at the end of the game against the 2013 Seahawks. And that drive ended in an interception. They moved the ball. I don't dispute that.
I'm sorry, but like, you understand what I'm saying. No, and again, but
moving the ball is not the same scoring a touchdown.
I said they were relying on unreplicable things.
Their pass
How many times are they going to have an interception on that series? And how many times are they going to score a touchdown? You play that series out 1,000 times. How many times is it going to end one way? And how many times is it going to end the other way? Look, a great thing happened.
I don't think their win probability ever got above 20% in that game.
I'm just saying the way that this deep you it relies on elite level talent and turnovers. And those two things, I don't think it's a bad defense. I think fundamentally, if you have bad players, though, it just doesn't really work. But I wish it was the type of situation like Let Russ Cook, where there was just a fucking cheat out there, where you could be like, there's something waiting for us to just be like, if we just do this one thing, it's going to fix everything. And I don't believe that that exists for the defense. I don't think it's blitzing. I don't think it's not blitzing. There's no answer. It's not man defense. It's not cover three. There's no answer to this defense. It's just bad. There's no like golden goose waiting for them to just fix it.
I mean, I disagree with your argument that they don't have good players because they have some individually amazing defensive players. But one of the things that's true about defense, much more so than offense, other than maybe the offensive line, we've talked about this before. It's strong link versus weak link. A defense is weak. Defense tends to be more weak link, where you're only as good, generally speaking, is your worst player. And teams have been able to pick apart one of the Seahawks corners on a regular basis all season long. Now, Trey Flowers actually quietly had probably a pretty good game on Sunday. Most of the damage was done on the opposite side of the field from him. And maybe if, you know, Flowers is able to take over for Dunbar when Shaquille Griffin is back healthy, then maybe that is enough. But
is it that though, or is it the scheme? Like, is it that this scheme is designed?
But you just said it wasn't the scheme. You said it was the quality that it was designed around the quality of the play.
I'm saying that if you have Earl Thomas in his prime, Richard Sherman in his prime, Bobby Wagner in his prime, Michael Bennett in his prime, that no matter what scheme you're running, you will be good.
Fair.
But they don't have to be.
That's the thing about the defense is it doesn't have to be good because the offense is good.
It just has to be not the worst defense in the league.
And they're not the worst defense in the league. No, they're in pass defense. They're much closer. They're the fourth worst pass defense.
The Bills laid a fucking blueprint there and they roasted the Seahawks in this game. Like this wasn't just that the defense was bad. It was that they were outcoached. They were outcoached at the head coach level, at the defensive coordinator level, and every other defensive level from there. They were outcoached. They went into a game expecting the Bills to do what they did against the Patriots, and the Bills slapped them in the ass with it, right? They said, like, you have to give credit to the Bills for this game. That's it.
I do. Yeah.
The Bills came out, and right when we saw them passing, it was just like, whoa, shit. It was like this. I don't like this. What they're doing. You want to see Devin Singletary for 4 yards. You didn't want to see these passes consistently for first downs on first and second down.
I don't know if the Rams are going to come out and throw this heavily on Sunday.
It's not as much in the Rams' nature to do that. But when they look at the game tape and they're like, wow, the Bills just didn't care about running the ball and killed the Seahawks defense. Why do you not want to do that?
They just built different ways. And first, it's not like the way the Rams play offense has not shown it can have a lot of success against the Seahawks offense and its or defense in its own right. Because we have, what was that, 2017 in Seattle? We have last year in LA where they just torched the Seahawks defense.
Every year against LA since Sean McVay.
I think in 2018, the Seahawks defense held its own against what was, you know, the best of those Rams teams, if not necessarily the best of those offenses.
They had a great game plan going into this game to pick up. Wait, I want to find the exact number. 206 electoral votes, I want to say. Something like that. Like they just didn't have a game plan to win them the game for this. And the Bills did. And I think you have to give a lot of credit to the Bills for having in consecutive weeks, looking at the weaknesses of these two teams and saying, we are going to be a running team 1 week and we're going to be a passing team the next week. And Josh Allen for being able to execute it. I honestly did not think Josh Allen had it in him, and he clearly did, because you know what? Every quarterback against this defense has it in them.
Not every quarterback.
Severely injured Jimmy Garoppolo. That's it.
Yeah, no, Brian Daboll has done an outstanding job this season. It occurred to me when they first showed him in the booth on Sunday that we didn't mention him once during the preview, and that was a mistake, because
it's a professional staff. It is, and they have good receivers. They have multiple good receivers. They had multiple open players, and the Seahawks defense got roasted. And also, so the thing that bothers me the most is the consumption with the idea of pressure. I think pressure is a fallacy, because they are so consumed with this idea of getting pressure on the quarterback. Gotta have pressure. Have to have pressure. Pressure is everything. Pressure, pressure, pressure. This offseason, we even argued that the Seahawks were smart, because they were like, we're valuing the secondary over pressure. They're modern thinkers when it comes to defense. Nope! They're not modern thinkers when it comes to defense. They just are trying to get pressure from a safety instead of a linebacker or defensive lineman. They fundamentally do not know how to use Jamal Adams.
That might be the best way to use Jamal Adams.
Telegraphing these blitzes.
I don't know if I agree with that, because he's getting home a lot of the time. Like,
I mean, getting home a lot of the time, that's great. A sack and a half is awesome when you're giving up 500 yards passing. Give me a fucking safety who's playing safety.
Can I tell you about a team that seems to be having some issues with some pressure? That pressure seems to be causing some problems for their offense? It's the Seattle fucking Seahawks! The book is out. Also, you might be talking about the book on defense that the Seahawks defense that the Bills wrote. The book on the Seahawks offense is out. It started with the Cardinals in the second half of that game. San Francisco was not able and did not execute it, but Buffalo did, and they got a lot of pressure on Russell Wilson. They aggressively blitzed him, and they caused him a lot of problems, including 4 turnovers.
Right? It's wild that we can't deal with this. We should be able to. It feels like it's a team.
Because you saw Buffalo adjust to it. You saw them start using
the
screen game.
Our head coach is 86 years old and just signed a contract for another 20 years.
I don't think it's fair to say that
things on the fly. We're a perfect scenario team. True or false, the Seahawks are the 16th best team in the league.
That's false.
When you know deep down inside where they rank.
Offense is more important than defense, but
nobody tried to pressure this team before. It takes time to get your receivers downfield.
I mean, in the past, when the teams have tried to pressure Russell Wilson, it's been the very worst thing you can do, because he's just going to uncork a 50-yard pass to Doug Baldwin. But it's or Tyler
Doug
Lockett.
Baldwin ain't walking through that door.
Or Tyler Lockett, also very good against coverage.
I think DK Metcalf is probably the best deep threat that Russ has ever had.
But those guys are exceptionally good at winning one-on-one when there's not help over the top. I mean, not that DK is not good at that, but they just have an incredible knack for that. And what they also have is, you know, years and years of experience with Russell Wilson that DK Metcalf can't possibly have in his second season.
Okay, can I give you an alternate take here?
But Tyler Lockett is still on the team, so that's not what's changed.
And I didn't have an amazing game on Sunday, but can I give you an alternate take? They were like 3 plays away from winning this game, ultimately. Like, there were balls that I feel like in the past they might have caught that for whatever reason on Sunday they just didn't.
Yeah, I mean, the pass that Russ just threw up is a complete prayer to Tyler Lockett. Lockett had it in his hands. He probably should have made the catch.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was extremely improbable to get to that point, but once you got to that point, it actually was unlucky to not score.
And it's a catch that Lockett, like, from what we know about Tyler Lockett, we expect him to make. Probably should have been a catch. The first interception was frustrating, but, like, it's not a play you expect to see that often. Most often when they get to the red zone, you expect the Seahawks to score.
I mean, they were due for some regression to the mean in the red zone, and it hit hard in the form of turnovers. Like, they'd been scoring at an unsustainably hot pace.
But the ball to Swain, where it felt like Freddie Swain could have caught it, and maybe
I don't agree with that.
That ball was knocked out. That's no one is catching that.
But there have been, you know, players have made incredible catches for the team this year. And
yeah, but not with someone's hand in the knocking away the ball.
Now, I think that this game came down to
if you want to talk about the first red zone interception, the thing that people aren't talking about is DJ Dallas was on the sideline getting checked out after what may have been a helmet-to-helmet hit, at least was a hit after he had stepped out of bounds, and then they weren't comfortable running the ball because they were down their top three running backs in that situation. It was a fourth and one, right?
No.
It was longer than fourth and one, but
it's like fourth and long that he threw that ball up.
It was not fourth and long. It was third and long when he threw the second interception.
And it was defended well. The Bills defended that play well. And, you know, we talked about the Bills defense was going to look better than it looked.
Yeah, it was fourth and one on that. That
was fourth and one.
Yeah.
Wow.
And they just didn't run the ball because they had Travis Homer in there.
I do think that Chris Carson makes a difference too. Like, I think Chris Carson is a good running back, and I think he makes a severe difference to the Seahawks offense. There's a big difference between Chris Carson and Travis Homer, and between Chris Carson and DJ Dallas.
At the very least, Chris Carson changes what they're willing to do.
Sure, we'll accept that. But I do think that is it's a pretty big difference being without your starting running back, you know, and somebody who you talk about that comfort level. Like, I don't know if it's time to panic about the offense. I think the offense will be fine. I think the offense will finish as a top five offense in the league. I don't know if it's time to panic about the defense. The thing that bothers me about Jamal Adams, though, is that he ends up in this no man's land a lot of the time. If either he's blitzing or if he's showing blitz and then dropping back, he ends up in this weird intermediate zone where he's not really doing anything. I think him being in coverage is more valuable than him. It's one or the other. Either you're going to blitz Jamal Adams or you're going to play him in coverage. But if you're going to show blitz and then have him end up in this weird, like 3 to 5 yard situation, that does not work.
I mean, I don't think you want that against Stephon Diggs, but not every receiver in the NFL is Stephon Diggs. And also Jamal Adams, as Pete Carroll said,
have good receivers.
Okay, I mean, a lot of teams have good receivers that don't play in the slot and aren't being covered by strong safeties.
Okay,
strong
this Rams are not team has expected just as good receivers who play out of the slot
sure,
as the Bills
this
do.
Rams team does, but I'm saying if you're expecting any strong safety to consistently match up with a number one receiver, that is on the scheme. That is not on the player.
But he was not put in a position to succeed for that.
No one would be put in a position to succeed for that.
There's also a luck factor too. And third downs were a factor. Like, the Bills still got lucky in this game. I think the scheme was bad. And the, you know, like the blitz that they dialed up on that third and long that was just comfortably picked up by the Bills was just like, I personally, I'm anti-blitzing schematically. I fucking hate blitzing, but
I would like to give you an argument for blitzing here.
All right. I would love to hear it.
And I think this
blitzing is the goal line fade of defenses. But tell me your argument.
The more effective offenses are, the more useful it becomes to blitz. So I always think back to in college, my roommate and I used to play a lot of, I don't even know which year's Madden this was. I guess 03, maybe 02.
I don't know what you went to college.
It was a long time ago.
I'm curious where this is going because it sounds relevant.
in that game, offenses were dramatically had the upper hand over defenses. And basically, you could sit back in like a cover two man, which is a two man under, which is my favorite defense in Madden, like an extremely conservative defense.
Base defense, yeah.
And you would just get slowly picked apart. So instead, what the strategy that I came to, and I think that my roommate came to as well, is like, you have to be as aggressive as possible on defense, because if it doesn't work, okay, then we're going to score anyway. And if it does work, you might be able to disrupt the offense, get them out of what they were doing, and actually create a stop. And I think that's kind of where we are with the Seahawks, both on offense and defense.
That's not the fundamental basis of this defense, though.
I mean, what's the fundamental basis of any defense in 2020?
But a Pete Carroll defense is based around you give up yards, you give up yards, you give up yards, right? Like, we know that. And the goal is
that shit doesn't work in 2020.
No shit. We've seen it not work.
So you can't complain about the base defense and the blitzes. Like, what other option are you looking for? You want Pete Carroll to like dial up a 3-4 in the middle of the season?
I would
Tony
rather
Dungy style Tampa 2?
Try to get a quarterback to make a mistake?
I think that's part of what the blitzing is.
But those give up big plays. They give up explosive plays. It's fundamentally against what Pete Carroll is about as a defensive coach.
Well, again, I think what he's about as a defensive coach isn't working. So you can't complain about him not adjusting and then complain about the adjustment. You're doing both. Like, in part, you're it's like,
to me, the adjustment is where the blitz is coming from, though. What did they do well against San Francisco? They blitzed linebackers. They weren't blitzing safeties.
But they they were blitzing off the edge as well as linebackers, and that's what was allowing Bobby Wagner to get home on the delayed blitz, because you send more than
this to pick
up.
Was off the edge Ryan Neal, Quandre Diggs, or was it KJ Wright?
It was DJ Reed a lot of the time in that game from the slot.
Maybe the personnel
isn't good
enough. I think
a lot of this is results-based. Or it's also like looking, if there's a situation with two bad alternatives, then whichever one you choose, you complain about that one because you don't have to see the shitty thing that would have happened with the other alternative.
Okay. You think the process for, still only the 24th, kind of crazy, but for the 29th worst pass defense is results-based?
But complaining about the blitzing when they're already so bad. Like, yeah, the blitzing didn't work on 3rd and 16. Well, guess what? When they didn't blitz, that didn't work super great on 3rd down either.
Don't do it on 3rd and 16.
Like, they would have just completed a pass. They would have just gone at Quentin Dunbar and completed a pass. Like, you can't just have a quarterback who's completely unable to cover. There's no scheme around that.
Well, we have a savior in the name of Lyndon Stevens. Lord.
I mean, obviously,
I don't know. That's what I'm saying, is we don't know the answer.
The Seahawks need to completely rethink everything they're doing on defense, but you can't do that in week 10.
There's no easy answer.
You have to do that during the offseason.
But that's why they trade for players like Carlos Dunlap. Let him fucking go.
They did let him go.
And I thought he played a good game, but let him go and let your secondary cover behind him.
Couldn't cover behind him. That's the whole point. That's why they were down 20. They didn't start the game blitzing. They started the game playing off coverage and giving up 10-yard completion after 10-yard completion. God. What game were you watching?
I don't know. There's no answer. There's no answer to this. The defense is bad and will always be bad.
So you try to choose the worst, the best, like the least bad alternative. Much like democracy.
I really came full circle. I don't know. I wish that I could say better what the answer to this issue is. And I think the only answer to the issue is somehow baiting teams is running the ball.
If there was a simple answer, they would have found it by now.
Yeah. I mean, having a healthy defense would be the simple answer.
But like, you can't just count on that. Players are going to be injured. It's not like they've had 49ers level injuries on defense.
If they could go back and redo like 3 or 4 draft picks that they screwed up, that'd be the simple answer. If they could just draft Huskies when they should have drafted Huskies, they could just have Buda Baker on the team. Like
they could just have Sidney Jones.
Oh,
we never got to see him healthy.
The defense is bad, and it's going to be bad. We can fucking tweet the picture of John Schneider every time a defensive lineman gets released and just be like, alert, John Schneider, Tack McKinley's out there. And it's like, you know what, dude? Like, it maybe ain't going to get better.
Maybe the fact that he got released by the Falcons is not the surest indication that he's an elite defender.
I mean, they obviously paid quite a bit for Carlos Dunlap, not in terms of assets, but in terms of his contract. And I think Carlos Dunlap was their best pass rusher on Sunday, which was really cool to see.
No question about it. I mean, Jamal Adams, I guess, would be the question.
Well, I guess having a valuable defensive end Leo linebacker pass rushing is so much more valuable than a safety linebacking because you're not or pass rushing because you're not also giving up something else. There's no give and take when it comes to that. Pressure from the line is more important than pressure coming from other places or more valuable.
Yeah, but Jadeveon Clowney didn't get any sacks though. So should we talk about the Rams?
I mean, I don't think things would be different with Clowney either.
No, probably not. They were 21st in defensive DVOA last year. The Rams hit the bye week at 5-3 after a 28-17 loss to the Dolphins. Four of their five wins so far are against the NFC East, the other one coming at home versus Chicago. And five of their final eight games will come against NFC West foes, including a pair against the Seahawks. The eternal Rams question, how good is Jared Goff? He regressed badly in 2019 from the season that ended in a Super Bowl loss, going from 8.4 yards per attempt to 7.4. Through the first 5 weeks of this season, it looked like he was bouncing back when he was completing 72% of his passes for 9.0 yards per attempt. But that was against weak competition, and then he went 19 of 38 for 198 yards in a loss at San Francisco and had a truly wretched game in their loss at Miami, where he threw for 355 yards, but on 61 pass attempts.
Wild.
With two interceptions and two lost fumbles. He now ranks 23rd in Ben Baldwin's composite QB stat Dakota after ranking 20th last season.
And 20th in DVOA, 24th in QBR, so that feels pretty much dead on for where the season has gone for Jared Goff.
Yeah, I mean, he's a bottom third quarterback, starting quarterback. Cooper Kupp leads the team in target share, but is averaging just 7.4 yards per target, a bit lower than their other wide receivers and tight ends, all of whom are pretty effective. And that's way down from 8.7 yards per target last year and 10.3 back in 2018. After waiving generational talent Todd Gurley over the offseason, the Rams have slipped all the way to first in rushing DVOA.
Are they first?
Yeah, they are, sure are. Second-year running back Darrell Henderson Jr. has taken over the committee and ranks second in DVOA, third in DR. Henderson left the Miami game with a quad injury, but should be good to go after the bye week. Too late for my fantasy team that week. Malcolm Brown, the most experienced Rams running back, hasn't been very good as a receiver this year, and second-round pick Cam Akers had largely been phased out before getting some opportunities in that Miami game.
I'm aware.
Yes. Of course, I mean, the other thing the Rams do is involve a lot of plays off the edge, Robert Woods end arounds, things like that, that the Seahawks always tend to over-pursue and get destroyed by. Defensively, they replaced legendary coordinator Wade Phillips with 37-year-old Brandon Staley, who had just 3 years of NFL experience, all under Vic Fangio, and the defense has been about the same. Aaron Donald remains the NFL's most disruptive defender with 9 sacks in 8 games. Leonard Floyd has added 4 as the primary edge rusher. Our old friend, speaking of drafting Huskies, Taylor Rapp, lost his starting job in preseason to 6th-round pick Jordan Fuller, but regained it when Fuller went on IR.
Fuller, wow, really? He straight up lost the job.
Yeah, Fuller has been designated to return this week, so Rapp may be back to sub packages.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe this is the Husky bias, but I was under the impression that Taylor Rapp was playing quite well.
I mean, they were excited about him as a rookie. I think long-term, they probably see him as the strong safety there with Fuller as the free safety. And I think it's Jerron Johnson as the veteran safety who's, I think I read that his contract is up, so he may be on the outs eventually. Also, I forgot to get, as we were talking about Aaron Donald, I forgot to get to this trivia, which is which player in the NFL has sacked Russell Wilson the most times in his career?
I'm assuming it's not Aaron Donald because you're asking it.
I mean, I thought you would assume that it was Aaron Donald because I was asking it. That's certainly what caused me to look it up, but he is third with 12 career sacks against Russell Wilson.
More than 12. Okay. Man, that's a tough question. Somebody has sacked him more than 12 times?
Two people?
I really got nothing.
All right, one of them is a former teammate of Aaron Donald's. He was not the Rams player with the most sacks against Russell Wilson.
Sue?
No.
Who?
Robert Quinn with 14. And the other plays for another NFC West nemesis. All of these sacks happened in games at CenturyLink Field, none of them in home games for this player.
It's a Cardinals player, right?
Yes.
Oh my God.
This player did not play in the most recent Seahawks Cardinals matchup as he is currently injured.
Not Chandler Jones.
It is Chandler Jones with 14.
Really?
Yep.
He's had that many opportunities. He hasn't been on the Cardinals for that long.
He's not enough,
I suppose.
Not been on the Cardinals for that long. He has played 9 career games against the Seahawks and has, you know, and he also had a sack against Wilson in New England.
And so how many does he have?
14 and a half total, 13 and a half in 9 games with the Cardinals.
Shit. All right.
I guess one of those came in this. Was he still? Yeah, he must have still been on the Patriots in the Super Bowl.
Yes.
So there you go.
Great.
There you go. Kicking has been an issue for the Rams. They drafted Sam Sloman in the 7th round. He went 18 of 21 on extra points and also missed a 29-yard field goal in week 1 and was waived after missing a 48-yard field goal against the Bears. The Rams then signed journeyman Kai Forbath, who, wait for it, missed a 48-yard field goal against the Dolphins. Only Tennessee has lost more expected value on kicks per Football Outsiders.
Really? Maybe they should have signed Greg Zuerlein. Re-signed Greg Zuerlein, who, of course, lost them that game last year in Seattle. I just have such a hard time of what to make of this game. You know, I would say that preseason, you circle this one as maybe the hardest game of the year.
Harder than at San Francisco at that point? Just because of the matchup?
I'm going to still say yes. Okay. You know, they played San Francisco much better, even though they went 1-1 against both teams and won in different locations the previous year. They've had a lot of trouble against Sean McVay teams. And, you know, I think we knew that San Francisco was due for a bounce back or due for some regression and that the Rams were due to bounce back a little bit. I just really think that Sean McVay understands this defense and how to attack it. And both coupled with that, you have a defense who is not very healthy on the outside, you know? And if they come at this and they're like, Jared Goff's going to pass the ball 61 times and they're going to find the soft spots in the zone, I don't know what the Seahawks can do about that.
Russell Wilson has not played very well against this Rams defense. He was quite good at in the home win last year, going 17 of 23 for 268 yards and 4 touchdowns. But other than that, the numbers are not great.
I mean, you know, he's like most quarterbacks and doesn't do very well under pressure. And Aaron Donald, if you're aware of this, is
unblockable.
World-class wrecking crew.
Yeah, I don't feel good. I don't feel good about this game at all.
Nothing about it. I mean, like, can we be surprised? Like, I don't think there's any game that the Seahawks going to expecting to lose, but can we feel confident about it?
I mean, there are games that the Seahawks going to not favored, and this is one of them, the first of the season.
Yeah, the first game that they won't be favored the year. It's close, you know, like it's within the margin of if they're still kind of factoring this in with the odds makers, home points margin, if you're giving them 3, 2.5 points. You know, it's almost a borderline pick 'em at Rams -1.5. And I think that's kind of where you have to end up being with this one. It's like, we know that the Seahawks offense is very good. They will bounce back from last week. I don't see Russell Wilson with another 4 turnovers or whatever. You know, where the pressure is coming from on the inside, maybe it's a little bit different. Maybe Russ is able to get outside a little bit more. They're not going to bring their linebackers as much as Buffalo will, or as much as, you know, the exotic blitzing that Arizona had. If they're going to blitz a ton, also, I would have to hope that over this last week, they've thought about that and done something about it. You know, the thing is that Bills game reminded me the most of some of the frustrating losses that we've had over the years. You know, I think back to Russell Wilson's rookie year and that loss at Miami and his the week after the bye. One of those games where you're just like, what happened? Like, why? I know they've been very good at 10 a.m. starts, sluggish defensively. And I think the offense took a while to just get going. You know, the first quarter for Russell Wilson, it was one of the worst first quarters for any quarterback throughout the NFL. So this is going to be a different game.
I mean, we just said they don't match up well offensively and they don't match up well defensively. So they match up great in terms of
special teams. I don't feel confident. I'm not saying I feel confident about this game, but I think it ends up being, you know, like the Seahawks defense is better, or the Seahawks offense is better than the Rams offense is, obviously. And
yeah,
is that going to be a big enough factor than the difference between these two defenses?
I don't think so. I mean, 40% chance of victory sounds high.
I was going to say 36.5%.
Okay.
It's hard not to have nightmares about the game that they played in LA last year, which really wasn't close from the very beginning. And that's the one that I feel like you just have to keep coming back to. And a number of games against LA. I mean, they were lucky to beat them in Seattle with that field goal that probably should have gone in.
Yeah.
It hasn't been smooth sailing against the Rams. And then otherwise we have what? The game that Cooper Kupp dropped the winning touchdown. Like, they have not been able to figure out this Rams team. And say what you will about Sean McVay and Jared Goff, but they have been extraordinarily good against the Seahawks defense.
You said that as if people are like down on Sean McVay. I mean, they're not as high as when they were hiring like anyone who had ever met Sean McVay as a head coach, but I think
they've lost games to other teams though. Like, look, if Brian Flores was the Seahawks defensive coordinator, I'd feel a lot different about this game than I do right now.
I agree, but he's not.
No, I mean, it's like a person of the caliber of Brian Flores is a head coach. He's not a defensive coordinator, but like, there are teams who have been able to
wait. Phillips is out there.
They didn't make the playoffs last year. You know, like, that's what I mean by say what you will about Sean McVay and Jared Goff. They're not, you know, they're 5-3. This is an amazing team. They're not playing the fucking Chiefs. They're not playing an MVP winner.
But that's why the fact that they don't match up well is so meaningful.
They don't match up well because Sean McVay can read this bullshit defense that the Seahawks play and do whatever he wants against it. And if Jared Goff is competent enough to execute it, it's over.
Which he might not be. That's the reason.
Turnovers to me are the only thing that can change this game. If the Seahawks come up, if they are plus two net turnover margin, maybe that's a difference. But if they're negative four like they were in Buffalo, it's over.
Well, they're going to be blown out then. I mean, in terms of DVOA, these teams are even. The Rams are at home, and the Seahawks don't match up well on either side of the ball. It seems like a pretty open and shut case.
So the only place that I would say there's a difference is, yes, they're even in DVOA. The Seahawks are still so much better at the most important position on the field.
But DVOA is factoring that in. It's aware of, like, the quarterback is involved in more plays in DVOA. So I don't think you need to, like, adjust on forward.
I'm not adjusting. I'm just saying I'm not going to doubt Russell Wilson that much.
I mean, certainly they've got a chance to win.
I'm not going to go into this game expecting them to lose. Probabilistic perspective, I am. When I'm watching it, we're going to be in the moment. You know, when you think probabilistically,
is there a Ted Lassoism?
When you think probabilistically, everything you think is probabilistic. But when I'm watching this game, I'm still going to feel like Russell Wilson can score every time he has the ball. I've watched Russell Wilson and I know that he can score every time he has the ball. And that's what I've come to expect.
All right. On that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.